Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Decade Project, a One Heat Minute Productions Patreon first look podcast that you either A, hearing on our lovely Patreon, or B, you're hearing later in the year. What's The Decade Project? We mark a line in the sand, a decade, and cast our eyes back a decade to films that are either the behemoths of their year or the forgotten gems, and we ask ourselves some questions about them. I go through with an incredible black book of some of the best film minds in the world, and now I'm talking to one of my favorite people ever. He was in the Uber buses. He's a tenant psycho, and particularly he's the co-host and co-founder of another gigantic movie podcast out there, Die Hard on a Blank. And you've heard him on lots of One Heat Minute production shows, even so much so that people have thought that we just like found archival footage of really famous filmmakers. It's one Liam Billingham. How are you, my friend?
Hey, buddy. Very, very happy, of course, as always, to be here. This is super exciting. Tenet, the day that we're recording this, people are going to hear it much later, so I apologize. I'm going to the re-release, which will actually... technically be my third time seeing the movie in some kind of movie theater capacity. Once at a drive-in during COVID, once on 35 millimeter at the New Beverly.
Oh, wow.
Here in Los Angeles. And tonight will be the first IMAX 70. I just love it. Look, it's not from the year 2014, but it is. When you get to 2030, you know who to call.
I know who to call.
Yeah.
But we are talking about the films of 2014 and 2024. So... what film are we talking about? And from what filmmaker, Liam Billingham?
So you might have to help me with the pronunciation of the last name, but we are talking about the film A Most Wanted Man from the year of 2014, directed by Anton Corbijn, the famous Dutch music video director turned feature director who's made kind of only bangers, particularly The American with George Clooney, which I believe he made before this, which is a movie that it's kind of like a hitman movie by way of Antonioni that I sort of admire. But yes, we're talking about this film, and notably A Most Wanted Man is the final film starring Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it.
We're here. Because German intelligence needs a job done. That German law won't let it do.
A terrorist has come to Hamburg seeking to make contact with Islamist cells.
Karpov, Issa, Chechen, 26.
World's nose is out there.
Hello, Issa. It's not safe to stay here.
We know Karpov's long-term objective.
Not yet, and if we move against him now, we never will.
We're not policemen.
We're spies. Mr. Karpov is not the bad guy.
They're moving.
He's our way to the bad guy.
You want to own Karpov? How are you going to do that?
Our sources don't come to us. We find them.
Hayanova!
I don't want anybody else getting close to him before we do.
Word is the Americans are taking an interest.
Watch your back.
You can't do this. I'm a lawyer.
You've crossed the line. You're on their side now. I'm not doing this for you.
Your choice is between us and nobody. The clock is ticking. All I'm asking for is more time.
And if this kid lets off a bomb?
Every good man has a little bit of bad, doesn't he? But that little bit just might kill him.
We can't undo what's done. There's no going back for any of us.
An absolutely criminally underseen movie. If you've never heard anything about it, it is a Jean Le Carré adaptation. That the films there, including Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Class, are people like in the class of actors here. We've got Rachel McAdams, we've got Daniel Brühl, we've got Robin Wright, we've got Hayman Ashadi. It is Nina Hoss, Vicky Creeps. Gotta love
crazy cast coming crazy 5 years later. These people are going to explode, kind of 10 years later.
Crazy cast. And so what we do here on the Decade Project is we go back and we talk about how it was received at the time. And so I guess one of the things that I've observed, obviously, is it didn't have a massive financial release. It made around 30 to 40 million bucks in its preliminary release. Not something that, not unusual for it. It's got a great, it has a great sort of overwhelming kind of critically positive score. Like you've got, Guy Lodge said, Corbijn found richer genre material for this gray, gusty aesthetic than 2010's supremely well-styled but emotionally vacant The American. So some people were giving it its props over the top of The American, but I just want to say this. I fucking love The American. I think I think George Clooney drinking coffee and building a gun and sleeping with really attractive Italian women at the beginning of that movie is... It has all the things I like. It's Seven Italy, tick. George Clooney building a gun and drinking coffee, tick. Which is probably why he got all those Nescafe ads, which is 100% great.
He went with coffee instead of gun ads. I think it was the right move to make professionally.
Charlton Heston took the wrong lesson from The American.
Just
went with the gun ads.
Ooh, cool.
Oh, so great. But so at the time, you just keep talking. Every one of these reviews, if you're going through the top critics on Rotten Tomatoes, which I do just to sort of get a general consensus on what people are saying, they're just like, everyone's talking about Hoffman. Everyone's talking about the movie's deft touch. Everyone's talking about all these different elements. So at the time, it was really well received. At the time, do you remember seeing this movie?
I saw this movie the day it opened.
Wow, that's great.
I committed. I was like, okay, this is my guy's final performance. So I have many people, I have a very loving, Phil Hoffman is my guy, from high school on. I remember in high school, I just would rewatch that scene from Hard Eight, Sydney, over and over again. I was obsessed with him in Magnolia. Every time I saw him in a movie, I was like, this guy just gets better and better. And actually, this is a digression, but have you seen Happiness, the film he did
is that Todd Haynes?
Todd Solondz.
Oh, Todd Solondz. Yeah, no, I saw it, I want to say a million years ago.
Very perverted film. It's very twisted. It's great. And George and I covered it on Uberbusters. We covered that and this film on Uberbusters, but he plays this guy who calls people on the phone and talks with this really depressing voice. Says things I want to fuck you. I want to fuck you so hard. And so I was on vacation with a friend once, and one of our recurring bits was just being like, hey, what's up? And him being like, what? And I'd be like, oh, fuck you. So it's the weird, we would yell, where is the rabbit's foot at each other? He just held this special place in my heart. And I, did a theater program in college and he was at the campus at the same time. And I would just like see him walking around, and I got to see him on stage. I got to see him direct. I got to go to an early rehearsal run of a play he directed called The Little Flower of East Orange with Ellen Burstyn. And who's that amazing actor who's in Miami Vice, who he works with? John Ortiz. John Ortiz was in it as well. And Phil Hoffman was just sitting there direct, like chatting with actors. And I was like, this guy is it. Like, this is the guy.
Yeah.
So when he died, I was on a plane to Texas for work. And I land and there's 5-6 text messages from various people being like, oh man, Phil. And I'm like, what are you talking? And then I read the news. So I was devastated. I like sat in my hotel room that night, just like, God, a light has gone out, as they say, right? Very affecting. And so when this movie came out, he died in February. This movie came out in July. I pre-booked a ticket to go up to Lincoln Center because I was living in New York at the time, and like made an afternoon of this. And I was like, I'm going to go like worship at the, it's like, you know, you don't get to go to someone's funeral because you don't know them. But this was, and this movie is funereal with this character. There's something, I don't want to assign something that isn't there with the movie, but it's impossible not to think about the significance of the character he plays.
Aren't all Le Carre movies funereal? Like all Le Carre texts.
Right.
Like I think, you know, form and function, right? Like I don't think it's a wrong read. I think it's actually a great read, but it's that whole thing of like a lot of these great characters. And I think about one of my other favorite Le Carre adaptions. I think Le Carre adaption, Tinker Tailor. It's like, that's you're watching these people who are just quietly dealing with betrayal and death constantly. And it has that quality about it of like we're right here. And just to talk about him for a second, I always tend to like just go through, but like if you go through his resume, you've got like very underrated early performances in things like Nobody's Fool.
Yep.
Heart Eight, Twister, Boogie Nights.
He's so good in Twister. He is so good in Twister.
He's just people, you know, I think the trailer for Twisters led a whole bunch of more memes of like him like coming back and people going like, we were wrong as a culture to not think he was the hottest man alive.
That movie's coming back. You know, like our buddy Chris Tapley is doing this 50 miles per hour podcast.
Yeah.
And so naturally Twister keeps coming up because I think a lot of people view Twister as like, it's not true. None of what I'm about to say is true, but there's this attitude about DeBont that's like, he makes this all time banger in Speed, one of the greatest movies ever made. And then after that, it's like, people are like, and then it's Twister. And it's like, no, Twister rules. Like, no, Twister is really good.
I want to stop you there. Twister fucking rules. Like, everyone, I people are like, oh, Twister. I'm like, what do you mean?
No, Twister's good.
The easiest movie to crowd please.
Yeah.
It's still peerless as far as like digital effects at that time. Like,
and no unmatched one, Paxton performance, too. I mean, may he rest as well. Like, incredible.
God,
incredible.
Talk about guys, two guys. Yeah, we recently did a Too Much Movie podcast on True Lies, which I know that you guys have on your Die Hard on a Blank schedule
with everybody's favorite film guy, Bilge Ibiri.
Exactly. And my theory was that James Cameron had to explode an atomic bomb in the Florida Keys to stop Bill Paxton from stealing the movie. That's the only way you could overshadow that performance. I think it's one of the greats. But you look at those guys and it's so fun and so terrifically put together. And that entire ensemble cast is excellent. And we didn't even get to that yet. So he then is in things like Magnolia. He's obviously a big PTA guy.
He's the heart and soul of Magnolia, I think, in a lot of ways. He's amazing in it.
Talented Mr. Ripley, mm-hmm. Almost Famous, 25th Hour. He's absolutely sensational. Later on, Cold Mountain. He's really terrific in that, underrated. He does Capote. Then he does Mission Impossible 3, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Charlie Wilson's War, one of the most memeable characters of all time, is Gus. the Greek secret agent, essentially.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Doubt. He's one of the voices in an Aussie film, Mary and Max, which is excellent.
Mary and Max. Yeah.
Love Mary and Max. Moneyball, another infinitely rewatchable film.
Yeah. That and movie then, made me sob like uncontrollably. I've only watched it once and on purpose because it ended. And I was like, I couldn't, I don't even watch baseball anymore. And I couldn't function for like 45 minutes. It destroyed me. I don't know why. You know, what's another film that you should shout out there that we didn't get, which is we didn't get enough comedy from him. And he's in Along Came Polly.
Along Came Polly is an all timer of all.
Where he talks about sharding.
Sharding. Brilliant.
Yeah, amazing. And The Master, which is a movie I've come around on. The first few times I couldn't get There'll Be Blood out of my head, but when I rewatched it for the Uberbuster season, I was like, oh fuck, this is a sort of masterpiece, especially of performances. It's amazing. I want to take you on a slow boat to China. That whole bit is so moving. It's so moving.
So I guess we've bridged the gap. The preliminary reception, it's good. It's a higher tier Licari adaption, which usually is a very perilous line to walk.
Yeah.
You come to kind of now, and the year of 2014, a very underrated banger of a year. This year, people are going to hear so many more Decade projects than I had originally forecast, I guess. Because when I cast the net out to people like yourself and asked, would anyone be interested, rather than sort of 16 films, which I did last year, this year it's 30 plus films from this year.
Well, we'll get into it later, but I have a terrible memory for when movies came out. Or I'll put it differently. I can often remember what year a movie came out, but I can't remember, like, I couldn't be like, and also this year, these other five or seven. So I did like a 2014 Google to make a list for you. And I was like, Jesus Christ, we used to eat when we used to eat. Like once
we
a week, we would
good.
Eat.
We were eating
and that's,
so good.
And that, you know, and it feels like it's finally coming back. But there was a period there where we just ate. It was amazing. It's a great year.
A really great year. Now, I want to talk about Anton Corbijn, which we're probably both butchering his name, but I want to talk about this, which is at this time in his career, he's a huge music video director, has like hundreds.
Right.
We've got people like, you know, Coldplay, Killers, U2, Depeche Mode, Roxette, Metallica, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Brian Adams, like Joni Mitchell, like there are Joy Division. There are so many things.
It's wild.
All the way back, like a crazy, it would be such a cool thing. I don't know if it actually exists, but it would be such a cool thing to be like, could you get all the Anton Corbijn like directed music videos on a Blu-ray somewhere so you could watch it?
Do you remember that set they did years ago with like Michael Cunningham and Spike Jones? Do you remember this? They would release the sets.
Yes.
And I had the, I think I had the Spike Jones one.
Yes.
And that was like a really cool thing that I feel like doesn't happen anymore, where they're like, they can get all the licensing agreements together to be like, here's everything. I mean, he directed Echo and the Bunnymen music videos. Like, that's amazing.
It is crazy. And so, but then you get up to his work as a feature filmmaker, and he makes Control 2007, which is a huge breakout for him as a feature director. He then goes on and makes The American, which is literally plucked right out of the 1970s, from the poster to the vibes to the everything. It is a big vibes movie and is a terrifically made thing in 2010. And he makes A Most Wanted Man in 2014. And then I'm trying to look, and there's a couple
like
of shorts.
What other movie?
Yeah, a couple of shorts. And then he goes up to Spirits in the Forest, which is a feature directed film. And
about Depeche Mode.
About Depeche Mode. And that's like.
Well, he made Life with Robert Pattinson and Dane DeHaan, which is about James Dean.
Yes.
Dean DeHaan's sort of like early. Dane DeHaan is excellent. Sort of an early part for him, right? Or like a kind of a breakthrough.
He makes that in the next year, and then he kind of doesn't make much. He's got something in pre-production called Switzerland, which I'd only heard about this morning, starring Helen Mirren, which is a mystery. But if we're talking about like what has aged in this movie or what has come forward, it's like, there's not that much. Like, you've got obviously Daniel Brühl, we can get to, Rachel McAdams, Robin Wright had huge decades and were having years, all of them in kind of 2014 onwards, but he doesn't seem to be as interested in making feature films. He's much more of a ongoing you know, music video director, which is kind of an odd one.
Yeah. So I feel like this, I haven't seen Control, I think, since I saw it on like a rip in 2007, wherever I was living in Prague at the time, and a buddy found it and we watched that. Or maybe we saw it in the theater because it probably got more play there than it did here. But I think if you look at The American and Most Wanted Man as like a pairing,
yeah,
you know, they have stories, but they're largely about mood and atmosphere, and they're, at least I think of them both, particularly in Most Wanted Man, because it's fresher in my mind, as character studies. Yes. Of individuals who like have chosen to lead lives that are outside of mainstream. They're not going to offices, they're, you know, investigators or murderers, they betray people professionally. Like, it's and he seems to be less interested in, like, you know, there's a version of both of these movies, like there's a version of The American that's like a hardware movie where, like, you know, he's assembling the gun, but it's like kind of dispassionate and just his job, like a way he functions. And in Most Wanted Man, it's like it's about the spy craft, but it's not about like the cool shit. It's not, you know, it's funny, in the past week I've rewatched Skyfall, because I got that $5 Blu-ray that I was talking about. So to watch Skyfall and A Most Wanted Man essentially back to back is really interesting, because like Skyfall rules, my favorite Bond movie, but it's like it ends with the fetishization of like the car, yeah, the gear, Money Penny. He calls Ray Fiennes M, and the camera just holds on them for like far too much time. You're like, we get it. We know what's happening. We get it.
Look at the big leather door. The leather door says it all, exactly. My friend. It's
exactly
beautiful.
But there's none of that in A Most Wanted Man, right? Of course, I mean, obviously it's different because Le Carré is like hard spy shit. Yeah. It's for the like, that's the hardcore spy people. Whereas,
well, if you watch A Pigeon Tunnel, you still don't know if this motherfucker was a spy. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah. I got it. You know, I watched a big chunk of that and I didn't finish it. I got to go back to it. But Corbijn seems more, I can't wait to hear a cut of the different ways we pronounce his last name in this episode. He seems to me to be more like, yeah, interested in the people and not even what brought them to this point, but who they are in the moment.
Yes.
And he gets really subtle performances out of Clooney, who's a good actor and particularly good when he's allowed to do what he does in The American. And I mean, Phil Hoffman's the greatest of his generation, in my opinion. And I can't wait to talk about this performance.
It's undisputed.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's hard to say.
So
it's amazing.
10 years later, it's another movie in 2014, which is you've got a most violent year.
But on my list, I think that movie's amazing.
And A Most Wanted Man. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the J.C. Chandor arc is getting more and more interesting, whereas Anton's arc, you know, as this sort of like European filmmaker and an aestheticist, probably primarily first before narrative,
yeah,
is making these really fascinating movies. And this movie, kind of other than the Hoffman of it all, I think when you're bridging the gap between when it was released and people making it appointment viewing, because they're like, I know that Philip Seymour Hoffman's in the Hunger Games, but I could care less.
I still haven't seen those. I haven't seen him in those. I've just never gone back and watched them.
The Hunger Games is, look, the first couple of Hunger Games movies are really terrific. And then it absolutely diabolically shits the bed in that thing that happened in the kind of early part of the last decade where every last movie had to be broken into two.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
they, you know,
so cynical.
It was just like, yeah, let's just break it into two. Is that the best thing for the story? No, but do we want to make money?
This is the sound of the money falling when you say that for studio head execs.
But that, you know, so people, I think this is one of those last ones. It's not the big one, but it's certainly really, really like a terrific performance. Phil plays Gunter Bachmann. Which I also love movies in some ways that both sometimes when they go really hard and they cast an actor and they're like, yeah, we're going to get him to do the accent and we're going to do this thing and we're going to be right there. And then other times it's like, we couldn't care less about the accents of the people. We're just going to have Rachel McAdams. Mm. We're going to have Willem Dafoe. We're going to have Philip Seymour Hoffman. We're just going to cast these people because they're going to be able to capture the mood of what we're trying to capture.
Yeah. I have to say, his accent work in this movie is like perfect. A fish to catch a barracuda to catch a shark. Like it's just very clean and even. And like, yeah, it's Phil Hoffman. But
do you think it wasn't going to be perfect when it's him?
No, I know. Well,
he's right. So good. This film was actually shot in September of 2012 in Hamburg, Germany. Took a little while to be released. I'm not sure why. I mean, because it was released in January. I don't know whether that was an intent, like at Sundance in early 2014. It later comes out
in
July.
He's still alive.
Still alive then. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether it's that whole, like, it was shot really speedily, had a long time post-production. They're like trying to figure out. Feels very American studio. What the hell is this movie? You know,
yeah,
where do
like
we...
too much intervention by the execs or something.
Yeah, and also, like, putting it as a July movie, this is not a summer movie. In the UK/Australia, we got it, like, after the American summer.
Well, you got it in September, huh?
Yeah, so September was UK, and I think it was around then in Australia. Like, I don't think we had it earlier than that. So I remember, like you, when I saw it 10 years ago, I saw it in cinema, but it was a small theaterette, and it went out to, like, our... what you call like art house cinemas here. Yeah. It wasn't a wide release. And I think it was
I don't think it was in the States either.
It was always hung on Hoffman as one of his final performances. So it was like, yeah, okay, cool. We have to watch this. It's Phil. And I remember at the time also, like, my friend Maria and I were doing we did a live podcast of our show like a million years ago called Pod Save Our Screen, which is like a little show that we did together. And we were doing a live show, and we had a photo shoot in a local paper about us doing this live show. Mm. And on the day that Hoffman passed away, so I still have a newspaper somewhere in my house that's like, Philip Seymour Hoffman passes away, and we're on like this page 2. And it was like crazy at the time to be like, oh my God, like
it was a big
deal. This is how it's memorialized, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's so. And, you know, this feels like the opportunity to talk about him in this movie, right?
Yes.
Because I don't, you know, I remember when, Heath Ledger passed away for The Dark Knight, and yeah, everyone kind of tried to ascribe the playing of the role of the Joker to that, which is like so absurd and so reductive and so simplistic, and certainly not something that you would want to do, like, because it's unfair and it doesn't make sense. But it's hard not to think about this movie in relation to, like, you know, the end of his life and the fact that it's so tragic, and he died of an overdose, and he was such a committed artist as an actor. And, you know, there's so many different things that I think about when I think about this. The first is, like, to watch him in this performance brings both joy and a little bit of sadness. The joy that it brings is the joy of seeing Philip Seymour Hoffman play a detective. Yeah. Like, it's not that far from a PI part.
It's
right.
Great. It's
manipulative.
It's right there. It's right there.
Right. I would read 20 books starring this character and I'd watch 10 movies. Right. And he's smart. He's charismatic. He's charming. I love that he drinks in the bars that he like catches people at. He has this heart of gold. He punches that guy in the face who slaps the lady. And then she's like, it's not that big of a deal. And he's like, it's not that big of a deal. So he's like both heroic and also naive at the same time. And also, like, as a guy who loves Vice, watching someone drink scotch and smoke cigarettes for 2 hours is like, oh, I just want, you know, I don't do that anymore because it's awful. But it feels really good to watch him essentially do like a film noir performance. At the same time, it's like, it's tough because it's his last movie and that character looks like shit throughout the whole movie and like doesn't sleep. And not to draw a parallel, but like, it's hard not to think about his passing in relationship to the movie. It's also, to watch him act is to be reminded of the very simple idea that, like, to be an expressive, interpretive performer is to be an artist. Like, he's such an artist. And I sometimes think actors get credit as being actors and not artists in the film world. And the directors do, and the writers do, and the cinematographers do. But, like, the things that he expresses with the smallest of gestures throughout this whole movie, and then the disappointment that plays over his face. And then when he finally gets fucked by Robin Wright Penn at the end of the movie, the two like guttural fucks that he lets out are like amazing. And that final shot of him pulling the car over, getting out, and the camera just lingering on the empty seat is like, you can't think of a more haunting send off for an actor who didn't make it to see the film get released. It's just so haunting that that's the final image of this. And I remember that crying at the end of the film when I saw it, because I was like, this is sort of the goodbye that most people will have to this guy.
Yeah. And it's also like the deployment of someone's talent is so key, I think. And when, you know, there's a, take this what you will, but the IMDb trivia has a great quote about him working with Andrew Bevel, who wrote this film. And he said on the characterization, he said he had a great empathy for him. He said the movie's about a lot of things, including how countries deal with terrorism, but it's also about a man who keeps doing the same thing and getting the same result. You get the feeling he can't stop. He really feels like he's trying to do the right thing. And I think actually he is, but the world isn't going along with the way of taking care of the bad guys of the planet. I was just so taken with his tunnel vision. He just thought it's going to work and they're going to see that I know, that I actually know. It's a hard way to live, to be someone who thinks if they could just see what I see, they'll get it. But they never let him get there, and he keeps going there. He suffers. And I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah, it's such a commitment. Yeah,
that is a man who knows, like, who knows it, who knows this, who knows this so deeply and reads this character and has such a clarity of it that it's like, oh, he gets it. And this is where I want to leap forward. We're going to take a quick break in just a second, and I want to talk a little bit. We'll definitely circle back to different parts and elements and aspects of the movie, the look, the feel, the tone. But I really want to talk about, like, the sliding doors, I guess, of opportunities that were this movie. So we'll come back after this quick break. About 2 months ago, someone, and I blame the internet really for not getting me onto this earlier.
I blame the internet too for most things.
I blame the internet. I watched the first episode of Slow Horses with Gary Oldman on Apple TV. Mm-hmm. And then I proceeded to watch the 3 seasons of Slow Horses, 6 episodes each on Apple TV.
I've only seen the first season, but it's amazing.
It's amazing. I watched 3 seasons in like 4 days. I'm a psycho. It was absolutely sensational. It's based on a series of books by Mick Herron. It's just a completely excellent series. It is a bridge, and this is the actual filmmakers and showrunner Will Smith who is guiding
not that
this.
Will Smith.
Not that Will Smith.
Yeah.
Another Will Smith who worked famously a lot with Amando Iannucci, and he basically says this is halfway between kind of an Iannucci thing and Le Carre is what he
totally
was going for. And
that makes sense.
And I'm like, yeah, that read is sensational. And I look at this and I look at Gary Oldman's Jackson Lamb, even though he's chewing scenery and just is slovenly and disgusting
farting
and rude and farting. And I'm like, this is kind of, this character feels to me like a character that
interesting
10 years later and his approach and his eclectic team of people and the betrayal that occurs feels like a guy who is like a much more optimistic kind of like Jackson Lamb character that Gary Oldman would later play in Slow Horses, because he's a guy who's trying to, like, he was actively in the post-terror era trying to get these people off the streets, trying to turn them, trying to get them out of harm's way, trying to get them to stop the impulse of doing X, Y, Z. But he's the kind of soured, awful, I've had to do these awful things guy that has not yet been retired to a cushy post somewhere else. So when I was watching this in preparation to talk to you today, largely probably because I had Slow Horses on the brain, but I was just looking at that and I was going, there is a lot of, like, there is something here in that Le Carre, this ensemble, this like smaller team, that it just all, it all tracked for me. And I was like, except obviously that it's in, you know, it's set in Germany rather than England. But it was like, I just kept watching it going, I'm feeling what this movie is doing now. And I'm thinking, God, we could have seen more of, I know that the novel doesn't necessarily have lots of sequels, but it's like, we could have seen more films like this. And to your point of like noir detective, Phil Seymour Hoffman, even though it's in an espionage film doing his sort of spy craft and living with that regret, I'm like, this movie just is brimming with it. And so it continues in the legacy of things like Slow Horses, but it kind of gets forgotten or swallowed up just in the lore of like, it's one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's last performances. So this is what we get.
Yeah. So I was thinking about something you said earlier, which is like, why did this movie have such a long window from production to release? And, you know, Daniel fucking Brühl is in this movie. And in the same year that Daniel Brühl is in this movie, no, I guess it's a couple of years later, he plays Baron Zemo in Avengers, right?
Yes, yes.
But you've got Nina Haas, who at this time is like exploded as an international. This is before Tar, of course, but she's been in a bunch of Christian Petzold movies like Barbara, I believe, had come out by this point, and Phoenix had come out by this point. And you have Vicky Krieps, who's like amazing in Phantom Thread, right? Mm-hmm. And there's all these great background players, you know, and Robin Wright Penn's in four scenes and she's amazing. She walks away in some place with the movie. She's amazing. But like, you have to wonder if like the original version of this was more of a team film than the one that we get. That Anton Corbijn, who's a brilliant guy, was sort of looking at the footage and going like, you know, I have this, you know, 2.5 hour cut and I got to make this a film movie. And I tend to think that probably isn't the case, but you could see it being true because there's so much that feels like it's left on the cutting room floor with those other players. Like Daniel Brühl has like 7 lines and 1 real scene in this movie. And he's already done Inglourious Basterds. He's famous and, you know, I have to wonder that some of the financing for this movie, part of the appeal to sell it in other territories was the fact that you had Daniel Brühl, who will bring in an audience in Germany, and you have Nina Haas. Like it's not outside the realm of possibility that, you know, was part of the thinking in it too.
All around that time, he's about to make Rush as Niki Lauda. He makes The Fifth Estate. He's
right.
He's then in A Most Wanted Man. He's been around, and then he gets the kind of Marvel money, like Inglourious Basterds 2009. He's in The Bourne Ultimatum too. He's made a stack.
He is in Bourne Ultimatum, right?
He's made a stack of movies, and he's big at that time. So it just feels like every one of these actors, when you say that, if you ask them who their favorite actor was, who's it going to be?
Yeah.
Robin Wright's going to say, oh, right now, my favorite guy working is Phil Seymour Hoffman.
Well, in the bonus features on the DVD that I got, Nina Haas is like, I'm a huge fan. And it was super stressful to like, at least initially, like until she started working with them. She's like, I have to be in scenes with, and Nina Haas is genius.
Yeah, she's great.
And so the fact that she's, you know, she's responsible for one of the great last scenes in movies, which is the last scene of Phoenix. Mm-hmm. But she is like, you know, flattering, you know, oh God, he's not flattering him. That's not the right word. She's like obsessed with him. She talks about it on the DVD. I can imagine everyone is like, holy fuck, I'm in, you know, and he's a really generous actor. You know, this is a little tangential, but there's a scene when they've sort of got Rachel McAdams in that holding cell, and he comes in and he's like, I want to help Issa. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to give him to the wolves, whatever. And she's laying on the bed facing away from him, and you can see her making the decision, and Phil Hoffman is in focus in the background. And you just, it's rare that you just watch someone standing and doing nothing. He's not doing anything. He's letting her have the scene, and you're looking at both of them. And it's just like, he's completely just like there for her. I mean, it's the great acting. It's the great acting is the reaction, right? So it's like, it's just amazing. Imagine just being in a scene with him because he's so good and he's so generous, and he never chooses scenery unless it's, you know, part for the
unless
role.
Unless the role defines. Yeah,
unless he calls someone a pig fuck or whatever he has to do in it, right? But it's like, he's just so generous and also so good and never takes up more space except in his sheer like ability as a fucking icon. But Yeah, I wonder if this was more of a team movie, which certainly, you know, is in line with, you've got the Dead Reckoning poster in the background there, right? Like, you know, it's like, this is like a low key hardcore spy movie with a team and assembled that way. But this film becomes a character study of like a self-destructive idealist.
Yes. And isn't it funny that he makes Mission Impossible and then he gets a kind of like a role of a spy lead, and they could not be two different things,
right?
From Gunter.
Are you a Mission Impossible 3 guy? Some people love it. Some people, I don't think, care for it that much. I think he's amazing in it.
I don't love the whole movie like as much as, and I don't put it on the rotational rewatch of my missions. It is in the kind of lower part of it. And I think some of the later movies really do justice to kind of bring some of the elements to the fore. But I would just say this, if you don't watch the Phil scenes and think, fuck,
where's
this guy
the
is the best villain that the series has maybe had, you're broken. Yeah. Like he's amazing. Like he's unparalleled. Like, and it's even funny, like hearing our good friends at the Light the Fuse podcast, Charles and Drew, like talking to De Palma, and De Palma's like, they're like, hey, have you seen any of the other Mission Impossibles? And like the one that he says, he's like, he does the great De Palma thing where he's like, Tom's always running. Why are you running, Tom? And then my favorite bit is he actually goes, I saw the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman. Like everyone was like, he was like, and he was fantastic. Like that was the thing. It was like, that villain makes the series. I always think that spy movies need great villains. And I think that he's absolutely unbelievable. And I think if there's one thing that in the wake of Fallout, it was hard for Dead Reckoning to find a villain that was, you know, much love to Isai Morales, but it was hard to find a villain that was as cool as Sean Harris plus Cavill, or Sean Harris in the previous one.
Sean Harris is excellent in Fallout.
He's excellent.
Fallout's my favorite. I really struggled with Dead Reckoning precisely for some of the things that you're describing. It's like it has amazing set pieces. The dialogue scenes are like hilarious and so well performed, but I like wanted a bad guy, and it's no disrespect to Sam Morales, but it's like, it's hard. He's like, I'm the bad guy, but really the bad guy is an AI. And it like never quite gelled for me, despite like, you know, the best train crash sequence like ever in a movie, like amazing. It really succeeds on the team aspect, though. It's one of the best team movies that the series has ever done. Oh, what's her name? The amazing French actress who's in Guardians of the Galaxy, who comes around. Pom Klementieff. Oh my God. Amazing. But, you know, to come back to your point about De Palma, I often wonder if part of, we're in this, you know, for the past 20 years, honestly, we've been in this kind of like period of, we still have these guys from the 70s who kind of like, you know, Scorsese, De Palma, all the big voices of guys who kind of like defined the new American cinema. And I bet one of the reasons De Palma loves Hoffman is because Hoffman reads as like a, he could have been in like any number of De Palma movies in the 70s or 80s.
Could have been in like, 10 De Palma. He could have been in early Scorsese's. He could have been like, people talk about, he was in, you know, Phil was in one of the great final movies for an aging master with Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
Exactly. Like he's an actor that those guys would deploy. Totally.
Yeah.
And he probably would have worked with Scorsese. This is the other thing, is that you start to think about what could have been.
Yeah.
He could have worked with Scorsese. You know, he could have done more PTA movies. He could have like, I mean, literally his son is the lead of the most recent PTA movie. Like it's a tragedy for his family because they lost, you know, a husband and a father and a person, and the American theater world lost like a great advocate for the art form. But we also just lost like a guy that we genuinely like spending time with, and who also wasn't afraid to provoke and push and do things as a performer that like when he's running in A Most Wanted Man, he is not a guy you picture as an action hero. One of the things that's great about him, but you're like, I would not fuck with that fucking guy. Like that guy would lay.
He looks like he'd, you know, like, what do the kids say? It's like, he looks like he'd throw hands. Like, he looks like a guy who, like, at a bar, if you got him really fired up, he would start throwing punches. Like, and you're like, yeah, okay, That completely tracks.
Yeah.
But that's how good he is, because this movie, even like when he's in The Master as Lancaster Dodd, he's like a fucking wild egomaniac, but he's not scary. But then you look at something which, you know, I also love too, like the, oh my God, I've just lost the name off the top of my head. Charlie Wilson's War, like Gus looks like he throw hands too. Like he smashes windows and he
you
just
believe
looks like
him as a murderer, like, or that he could kill someone, you know? And I think one of the things that he had that a lot of, so the Master works for me because everything about it on a superficial level seems, this is a film about a loner who falls in with a cult leader and their codependent relationship. Right. But what Anderson does is creates so much mystery in the relationship between these guys. Right. And, you know, it would be very reductive to be like, this is a movie about two men who are in love with each other. Do I think they're in love with each other? In a sense. But it's not like, I'm like, oh, if they just fucked, everything would be fine. It's not simple like that. And so it culminates.
Well, movies that you and I both love, one of them exactly. being Heat, people are like, if they just fucked, it would be fine.
I'm fucked. They basically fuck at the end. Like, let's be real. But it's like, yeah, I mean, it's dudes rock stuff. It's like, you know, Tenet, which is a movie about two men who kind of are in love with each other. But like the fact that it ends again,
much hotter younger men. Let's be real. Both smoke shows.
But the way he sings that song to Joaquin Phoenix at the end of the movie is like, it implies a whole life that's not going to be lived. And it's so much more interesting that is who he could convey mystery and space and leave room for you to think about what he's doing as an actor on screen. And at the same time, he's the guy in the office in this movie who's like, oh, it's 7:15 or sorry, it's 5:05. Let's get the scotch out. Like, it's just accepted. And I would say that also, it's very, you can interpret the relationship with Nina Haas. They're in love.
Yeah.
They're never going to tell each other.
No.
They're just going to live out this office romance without anything ever happening, except like, oh, we can kiss because we're undercover. The way Nina Haas leaves her hand on his shoulder after Rachel McAdams pulls away when they're kissing across the street, you're like, oh man, like, a lifetime of a relationship is conveyed in that. And that's what Corbjian is ultimately interested in. Is like, I'm not going to be like, have the scene where like, I love you. They look at each other at the end of the movie. And it reads to me as like, we can get out of this together. Let's just get the fuck out.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, he's so special and he's so mysterious despite being a guy that like, all you want to do is watch him. I mean, I could rewatch his movies again and again and again and again for years and always get something new.
You touched on something before we were joking about like, we were eating in 2014. And I feel like when you go back through Phil Seymour Hoffman's incredible resume, everything you watch, you're like, oh, we were eating.
Yep. We were eating.
We were eating. Like, listen, Charlie Wilson's War, Schenectady, New York.
Well, that motherfucker could open a movie. Like, he was still a movie star. Yeah. There aren't as many movie stars anymore that aren't connected to franchises at this stage. It's coming back. It's coming back a little bit.
It's coming back.
A little bit. Not completely, but like.
But it's also, he knew himself. He was a complete chameleonic guy. He could open a movie. You could be there day one. He completely perfectly oscillated between being in a movie and just fucking crushing as the supporting actor or being a leading man. He didn't really care. He was happy for what the assignment was. He was like, he understood the assignment of whatever it was going to be. He just did it. It's like, it's not like Chris Hemsworth, who like, even though with massive Thor movies and Avengers and stuff, it's like, it's only kind of now when he realizes that he could be kind of like Bogan, which is like a slang for Australian white trash, when he can be like Bogan Arnold Schwarzenegger, like it's like, oh, fuck.
He's amazing at it. He's amazing. Yeah.
So like, just like the charming Australian accent, like slapping kids or like fighting someone while his arm's on fire in the Extraction movies. I'm like, this is what he's been born to do. Like, we need like 10 more of these where he's like firing gigantic guns off a train and his gigantic biceps are like pulsating. Like, that's what you need. Like, but some actors never know themselves like Phil Seymour Hoffman knew himself.
He also like is hilarious.
Oh my God.
And I think like,
so funny.
Like, have you seen the American Express commercial that he did? And he's like, I can't do the accent, but he's like, they wanted someone who didn't look like that they wanted someone that looked like Thor that was not someone who was Thor. And then they laughed and then they gave me $7 million. And it's like so funny, right? Like, and like, I remember seeing that and being like, holy shit, like this guy needs, he's not meant for costume dramas. He's meant to, and you know, and I love the movie that I'm about to mention, which is a little movie called Black Hat.
Yeah, the director's cut's really good.
I haven't seen it yet. I got to get the disc. I haven't seen
it. Don't worry. There's only four versions of this movie. There's the theatrical version, the international version, the current director's cut, and then the director's cut that went to FX. So, you know, you only have to watch it four more times to fully get.
Send me the Dropbox link. But he, like, you know, he's straining a little bit and doing the incarcerated gladiator school tough guy who also reads Baudrillard kind of thing that he does, like that man wants him to do. And it's not like he's bad, but it's like he just hadn't hit that. He hadn't figured himself out yet when that movie came out.
No, and I think later on, for such an international movie that it was, I'm almost like, that's my biggest regret with Black Hat, genuinely, is that I think that Chris Hemsworth is phenomenally charming and a terrific actor. And I would just love him not have to do the business of having a very specific, you know, Midwestern American accent or like middle American accent, because it's sort of Chicago-ish, but him having to do all the labor of that specific, like thinking about how he's being deployed in that movie. Whereas I'm like, wouldn't it have been cooler if like an Australian prodigy goes to New York City to university with a Chinese prodigy and they meet each other and then he gets arrested because American won't we won't even ask because Australia won't extradite our own to come back and like he'll stay arrested. And it's like, and then he's American, he's Australian. I'm like,
yeah,
wouldn't that have been a fun, like, I mean, again, it's not the story that Michael Mann wanted to tell, but it's also like, that would kind of be fun for me. It's like, it's kind of the thing.
It'd be more truthful. It'd be more honest.
Yeah. It's like when Kevin Costner's Robin Hood and for the first 5 minutes of the movie, he's trying an accent. And then the rest of like the next 2 hours,
my lady. Yeah. It completely goes away.
He just gives it away. He's like, I'm not doing this. And I feel like that's what, but whereas Philip Seymour Hoffman can do fucking anything. He can do any accent.
Yeah.
He can do any tone. He can do silence, he can do big, he can do small, he can do completely fucking silly and steal a movie from Ben Stiller, like steal the movie out from under one of the funniest guys, just steal the fucking movie, like it's gone. Yeah. It's his. Along Came Polly, underrated.
I also think Jennifer Aniston is genius in it too, but yeah, that's a whole other yeah, it's kind of wild to think that she and Phil Hoffman were in a movie together. not at all in a bad way, but you're just like, these things don't really register. What is it that he yells when he shoots make it rain? Raindrop, like just it's it's so good.
We're kind of in the process of wrapping this up. It's the sons of novelists John le Carré, Simon, and Stephen Cornwell, you know, their dad's birth name was David Cornwell, started a production company and started being producers at this time, producing their dad's stuff. The two things that they did were A Most Wanted Man and the Liam Neeson thriller Unknown at the time. And I think they did that. I mean, A Walk Among Tombstones, I recently watched another 2014 movie for this project.
On my list, my friend.
It's great. So
Scott Frank.
So yeah, I really like it. And I just want to say of A Most Wanted Man, it never got the critical plaudits or like the physical media psychoness or the whole like Gary Oldman aura of like, okay, this is the Le Carré adaption. It's great. It didn't have the period. It's much more tactile and of its time, but man, this is such a sensational film.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that you brought it to my attention.
You'd seen it before, right? But just maybe
course,
not since.
Of course, I hadn't seen it.
Say you said that, right?
Years. I hadn't seen it in years. And I'm so glad you brought it to my attention for this project, because it really, truly feels like in the suite of films that we're going to cover in the Decade Project for 2014 and 2024, that this is one that could easily have been overlooked. And not even then just for the like the Philip Seymour Hoffman of it all, but like this is a truly terrific contemporary espionage movie. and doesn't do away with the things that we know that contemporary espionage movies do. They try and set themselves in periods. They try and take away technology. They try and hamstring right. themselves to be period films because it's just sometimes easier with the storytelling. It does everything that it needs to do. And I just, it's just such an kind of effortlessly understated and terrific movie. And it's so great. And I can't recommend it high enough. And we've just, you know, we've obviously the focus is Phil, but man, oh man, this is, you know, yeah. like, It's so good. And the final note I will just give before we get to your five faves from 2014 is that editor Claire Simpson, she did two Le Carre adaptations. The first one was The Constant Gardener back in 2005, which is a terrific movie.
I love that movie.
Haven't seen it in ages.
Me neither, but it rocked.
It rocks completely. A terrible name for the movie. I can't remember what my friend Maria suggested. He's just like, shouldn't this movie be called like Poisoning Babies? Like, you know, like or something, like, because it has that whole thing. It's The Constant Gardener. Really bad title. Really, really
suggestion
great.
For another name.
Suggestion
Rachel
for another
Weiss,
name.
Rachel Weiss, just in the movie. Let's just call it Rachel Weiss. Let's
Rachel
be
Weiss rocks. Yeah. And so great. And but she also did this one as well. So really interesting that she found herself there. Man, look, thank you so much. Before we wrap up.
Oh, dude.
2014, tell me your top five.
Well, I also just want to say that the very last thing I want to say about Phil Hoffman is that we just covered Eric Bogosian on Die Hard and Blank because he's an Under Siege too. And I think one of the things that as a guy that went to theater school and did theater for a while and then ended up, you know, doing movie stuff and the podcast is that I'm so into journeyman Renaissance American actors and performers and people that just like do everything, whether it's writing a play, directing a play, do anything across the spectrum, and to like have been alive and sort of in the loosest sense of the orbit of Philip Seymour Hoffman when I lived in New York, and to like be at the Public Theater and know that he was in the building was just like, it's thrilling in every conceivable way. And I think it's, he's such an important figure. And of course, everyone knows this, but I hope that people are talking about his movies forever because it's so deserved.
Any excuse. Twisters, any excuse. Let's go back and talk about that. New PTA, let's talk about all the great movies. Man. Every time someone discusses Mission Impossible, you have to come back and talk about him. But I mean, he's even so wonderful in The Big Lebowski.
Oh my God. Yeah, he's incredible.
One of the all-timers there, Brandt.
He's, yeah, I just rewatched.
It's like you cocked for $1,000.
This aggression will not stand, man. I recently, we've been doing deep. This is so tangential. We've been doing deep dives on John Milius for various Die Hard on a Blank episodes, and I've become deeply obsessed with Milius and the fact that Goodman partially based his performance on Milius.
Partially,
yeah, maybe all the way. So my top five, my number one is a documentary called Citizen Four, which is Laura Poitras's portrayal of Edward Snowden. That is a
great documentary
masterpiece.
Right.
Number two, A Most Violent Year, J.C. Chandor's kind of like crime drama set in the 80s about dump trucks being stolen in the greater New York City area with Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain, absolutely kicking ass. I think it's a great fucking movie.
Great movie.
Number three is Winter Sleep, Nuri Bilge Ceylan's Turkish.
I saw Winter Sleep at the Sydney Film Festival. Yeah.
And I love Nuri Bilge Ceylan. He made a film right before this that I feel like you and I should talk about sometime called Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, which is a great film. That's why I saw
Winter Sleep was because I'd never
I think
heard
burst it. Onto the scene with
burst
that
on
movie,
yeah
right?
Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. It was like holy shit, who the
but
hell
he made
is
a
this?
Couple movies before that that are also really good, and I think Winter Sleep is important because since Winter Sleep, he sort of entered this stage of his career where he makes these almost entirely the same length dramas, often set in the remote Turkish hills or villages. And he's been doing that for a long time, but there's something about the trifecta of Winter Sleep, The Wild Pear Tree, and the new one About Dry Grasses that seems like he's entered this phase. And
About Dry Grasses is something that has not even come close to getting a theatrical release in this country. So I have no idea when it's coming out, but yeah, like friends of ours, like Bill Ghirabiri, who we're both very close with, is like, this is great. You must see this. And all these great critics that I respect and are friendly with are like saying that this is a great movie and you have to see it. And I'm like, when Australia.
It's in LA right now for a week on the West Side, and at times that do not work with my life, and I'm very frustrated. So I need to figure out what I'm going to do, because I missed the New York Film Festival premiere of Wild Pear Tree for life reasons as well, and I've just never been able to watch his movies at home because it's a lift. Number four. I'm going to cover the movies that really made it. Okay, number four is The Grand Budapest Hotel, which I think is Wes Anderson's masterpiece. That movie, just the way that it's about fascism and the ending of a culture, and it's just amazing and a really entertaining movie that when you reflect on it, you're like, wow. Number five is a movie that I saw in the IMAX, didn't really do anything for me initially. I was kind of like, huh, my beloved Christopher Nolan lost a step. Weird. And then recently was on a plane from LA to New York and saw that Interstellar was available on the in-flight. Was like, okay, you know, this is a 5-hour flight and I'm on a plane with two children, so I might be able to get through most of this. And at a certain point, my son fell asleep and my daughter was just sitting next to me and I was eating snacks. I was watching the movie and handing her like applesauce pouches and her being like, Daddy, can I have an applesauce pouch? I'm like, here you go. Here's an apple sauce. Like,
you look like sobbing. McConaughey. You look like McConaughey.
Sobbing. Like, great just movie. Crying my eyes out. It's a fucking great movie. And I
had the same experience. I was soft on it. I saw it in IMAX when it first came out. And I have since come around to it so hard.
Yeah.
That it's crazy. It's
crazy. And it's an interesting thing to track in his career as the way that he sometimes will explicate everything on screen and then other times will not. And the way that this movie wears its heart on its shoulder is great, and I think it uses some of his most expressively beautiful filmmaking in the service of that. It's a far cry from everything that came before it. Honorable mentions,
sure.
A Walk Among the Tombstones, Scott Frank's film,
fucking great movie.
Nonstop, the Liam Neeson Die Hard on a Plane movie. Nightcrawler, the Jake Gyllenhaal journalism movie. That was when Jake Gyllenhaal was just playing dirtbags left, right, and center. Ex Machina, I think, is a really good movie. A movie that I bet you love called The Drop with Tom Hardy. Yeah, I like
James Gandolfini.
James Gandolfini, and one of his final ones.
Yeah.
And then I have to give a shout out. This is maybe surprising, but Captain America: Winter Soldier was one of the last times when I was like, huh.
Marvel kind of rocks.
And that's one that I revisit. Like, I've probably watched it once or twice. You know, that was a pandemic sort of like afternoon children are napping kind of turn on. And I think that like if that movie established a formula that they did really, really well for a while. And I think it's really strong. But it's in a different class from these others. I really think Citizen Four and Most Violent Year at the top of the list. A Most Wanted Man will forever reign as the Phil Hoffman performance that, you know, defined that year for me.
Liam Billingham, you're a legend. I love you. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for all of your great contributions to all of the crazy things that we do. And thank you for Die Hard on the Blank, which continues. I am hearing on the grapevine that there is a Die Hard on the Blank episode coming up with Heat, and it doesn't have me. And I want to say, thank
do you know
you.
Who it has?
I do.
Oh, okay, cool. I didn't know if you knew.
No, I got a text and the great Katie Walsh will be doing Heat. And she said, I will represent One Heat Minute Productions proudly. And I
look,
said,
we love you, but we think you deserve a break from talking about Heat all the time. You know, we'll get you in for something later. And your episode on the River Wild.
Which, had a great time. Had an absolutely outstanding time.
You know, I recently had to put together a list of the 10 best action movies of the 90s for another little podcast. This episode hasn't come out yet, but it's a podcast about a bus that can't slow down. Mm. And The River Wild was on my list.
Great.
And excellent. The host of that show gave me shit because I had a couple things that were like two movies for my number 9 spot. I was like, cut it the fuck out. And I was like, sorry. So you'll hear that at some point.
I cannot wait. People can find you really at Die Hard in the Blank. Very frequently.
I'm like Liam Billingham on Twitter. I haven't moved over to any of the other platforms yet. I'm still just riding the fascist wave of X.
I don't know if I can. I'll never call it X, but I don't know if I can ever leave.
It's too hard. I met you there. I mean, I met all the good people
there.
I met all
the good people there, too. I love it.
Yeah, people are like, you're still on there? I'm like, all my friends are on.
How do I know what everyone's doing?
Yeah, exactly.
That's where I'm going.
Where else can I talk about Tenet without my... Because my wife's like, shut up about that stupid movie. I don't care anymore. Call me in 6 years for 2030 so we can do Tenet.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Hopefully and before that.
We will definitely talk before. But also, yeah, there's still so much. You pointed out some other big ones that are in the year that are definitely on the list. So we may have to talk again, but you're the best.
Oh,
thank
please.
You so much for your time. And
yeah,
we'll definitely talk soon.
Yeah, take care. Be good.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in / promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.